Well, good morning to you. Good morning to you watching at the chapel at Crosspoint or watching online. What we're going to be doing today is a little bit different. We're here at the chapel at Lockport, continuing on in our Crossroads series. And so what we would like to do, you know what, chapel at Lockport, why don't you go ahead and say good morning to our church family at Crosspoint? Why don't you do that? Sweet. Very cool. Hey, you know, the other day I was reading a story about four young teenage guys who left home to study abroad in a major world city. And they were leaving home, you know, for the very first time, and you can imagine what that was like for them. It was a few years back, so it was before really cell phones or email, so they really weren't in constant contact like we are today. So they were really, truly on their own. So there they are leaving home for the very first time in what feels like on the other side of the world, really. And so there they are in this major world city. And I'm reading this story and I'm thinking, man, this is like every teenager's dream, right? I mean, here they are away from home, away from rules, away from their parents, away from curfew. No one's there telling them when to get up or when to go to bed or to clean up after themselves or to do their schoolwork or anything like that. I mean, they're truly out there. They're going to make their own decisions. And you know what? I was reading the story, and it said that these four guys, they were from kind of the upper crust of society back home. They were kind of from the upper echelon of their hometown, and so there was a lot of social pressure always on them to perform and to be, you know, good boys kind of a thing. And not only that, but their parents, their families, were all very devoutly religious people. They were very strict adherents to their faith, and so not only do you have all of this social pressure that's on them to perform, but they've also got all of this religious pressure to be good boys. And so finally, here they are studying abroad in a major world city, and they're ready for some release. And so think about, you know, what that must have been like for them. What would have been available to them in that major world city? And we're talking about a place that, you know, no minimum drinking age. And, you know, awesome nightlife and beautiful women everywhere. And for the next, I think, 3 years or so, there they'd be in that major world city studying abroad and have every opportunity for indulgence that they could even imagine. I mean, you could think that this would be something that a teenage guy or a teenager in general would jump at. Like, yeah, this is awesome. Not only that, but every other person in their program that was studying abroad in that city, they were taking it upon themselves to plunge headlong into the experience, so to speak, really just getting everything that they could out of that experience studying abroad. And, well, nothing seemed to be happening to them. Nothing bad seemed to happen to them at all, in fact. So what would be different for these four guys? I was reading the story, and they came to kind of a crossroads in their lives. Because for them, the question was this: Are we going to plunge headlong into the experience being here, studying abroad, away from home, no rules, no drinking age, just throw ourselves into the experience? Or are we going to be devout and follow the principles and the lifestyle that our parents passed down to us? That was the crossroads for them. And when you're at a crossroads, one thing can change everything. One decision can change everything. So for them, at this crossroads, it was this: are we going to plunge ourselves headlong into the experience, or are we going to follow a different path, one that our parents laid out for us? That's what I kind of saw as I read this story. And actually, let me show you how that story turned out. It's in the book of Daniel, chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, if you want to follow along. Daniel, chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, says this: in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, Babylonian names, that are more familiar to us. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. But don't miss this, verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Daniel resolved. Now, that story that I began by telling you, with no embellishment, with no exaggeration, and no stretching of the truth, those four young boys, young guys, young teenage guys, who left home to study abroad in a major world city, that's the story of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or as we know them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's their story, because that's exactly what they did. They were taken from Judah, carted off to Babylon, where for 3 years they'd be trained, they'd study, they'd be educated in Babylonian culture. And that was going to be their life for the next 3 years. And then after that, they'd be taken in and be servants of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what I don't want you to misunderstand about this story is we kind of read this and maybe at times think of it as a concentration camp scenario. And I don't say that to make light of concentration camp, but only to say we think that maybe they were struggling along with, you know, they were bound in chains and given like stale bread and polluted water. But if you read it a little more carefully, you see that they were actually given a pretty opulent lifestyle. They were actually quite comfortable. You see, Nebuchadnezzar's strategy for world domination was not such that he wanted to exterminate the people that he conquered. That wasn't his interest. Because what he thought was, my kingdom can spread faster, not if I just exterminate or wipe out a bunch of people, genocide. That's not going to do it. But what I am going to do is I'm going to retrain or reprogram the people that I conquer. Instead of just saying, well, let's wipe this people group out of existence, we'll reprogram them to think like a Babylonian. So what Nebuchadnezzar sought to do was to strip away their native culture, to strip away their faith, their belief, and their culture, and replace it with Babylonian thought, belief, and culture. You saw that in the text where they'd be trained in the language and literature of the Babylonians. That is the idea of Nebuchadnezzar. That was what he was trying to do, because if he could repopulate the earth with Babylonians, his power, his influence, his kingdom would spread that much quicker. So this wasn't a concentration camp, kind of bound in shackles existence. If anything, it was the opposite of that, because a prison-like experience, a prison-like existence for these guys, what would that do? Well, that would breed resentment towards the Babylonians and even potential mutiny towards the Babylonians. But that's not what Nebuchadnezzar was after. He didn't want that. So what did he do instead? He gave them a life of indulgence, a very comfortable existence. What would that breed? Well, that wouldn't breed resistance or potential resentment or mutiny. The indulgence would breed complacency and compromise, which was exactly what Nebuchadnezzar wanted to do. Nebuchadnezzar knew that the indoctrination began at the dinner table, that that's how he was going to start his reprogramming of these young men, these young Jewish men from Judea. If he could strip away their Jewishness and reprogram and replace it with a Babylonian culture, then they were his. And he knew that daily provision, listen, Nebuchadnezzar knew that daily provision would end up being a greater shackle than chains themselves. Think about that. Nebuchadnezzar knew that daily provision would become a greater and stronger shackle than even if they were bound in chains. Why? Because they were indebted to him. I mean, we kind of look at this story, and that's hard for us to grasp, but think about what it's like from their vantage point. Think about what it's like from Daniel's vantage point. I mean, he's ripped out of his home at a very early age. I mean, he doesn't know what awaits him in Babylon. He has no idea what's coming. And we'll come back to that thought, because, you know, you might be reading this and thinking, you know, why doesn't Daniel blend in? Why doesn't Daniel and his guys just go with the flow? And maybe that bothers you. Maybe that bothers you about Daniel, like, hey, man, keep it down, you know? It's like, hey, don't stand out here. You don't want to stand out here in Babylon. Just kind of lay low, blend in, and then, you know, maybe you'll be able to, you know, if you stay alive, you'll be of more use to God than if you were dead, kind of a thing. I mean, we do that with our stuff too, right? We do that in life, where we over-spiritualize things. And so we'll say, well, you know, I just kind of do these things when I'm at work or with my work friends or with my neighbor, because, you know, if I was to be ostracized, I wouldn't be able to influence them for Jesus someday. You know what I mean? Oh, I'm the only one that does that, apparently. Okay, that's good. That's good to know. And we do that. It's like, oh, well, wouldn't that be the more spiritual and God-honoring thing if Daniel would just blend in and lay low? But the scripture doesn't allow for that. Why? Because of Daniel 1:8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself. Well, how would Daniel defile himself? Look at our text beginning in verse 8 and continuing on. Daniel 1:8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. I mean, this seems like, Daniel, what's your deal? I mean, we live in this, you know, everything in moderation culture right now. That's kind of our mindset as human beings, particularly in this country. And so we're thinking, you know, everything in moderation, Daniel. What would be wrong with going along with the program here? I mean, you might even be thinking, you know, man, a filet paired with a nice Cabernet, what's so defiling about that, right? Well, this was more than just a dietary decision. This was more than just what Daniel would eat. There was much more going on here. Yes, it's true that as Jewish young men, they were raised and taught to observe kosher, right? And so they knew the kosher law, what they could eat and what they couldn't eat. And yes, within that kosher law, there were very specific instructions about meat that had the blood drained from it and meat that was sacrificed to idols. And you know, they weren't allowed to eat the meat that was sacrificed to idols. And if they couldn't eat meat, if the blood had not been drained from it, we get those things. And so maybe we look at Daniel 1:8 and say, oh, well, the food just wasn't kosher. So they said, no thanks. Well, I think that maybe there's more to it than that. Why? Because, well, actually the text right here in Daniel 1 gives no indication that either of those things were true. That this food wasn't kosher. That this food had been sacrificed to idols. We don't know that. In fact, I've already kind of showed you how shrewd of a man Nebuchadnezzar was. I mean, he was a very shrewd man. He was no dummy. And so I showed you that in order for them to breed complacency and compromise, they made their lives more comfortable in Babylon, not more difficult. So if Nebuchadnezzar is really that smart, if he really has his wits about him, what makes more sense? Okay, because he's no dummy. He's aware of the kosher law. He's aware of those things. Would it make sense, in keeping with everything else that he's done, to finally start here and say, well, we're going to pump you full of pork and shrimp and, you know, food that we sacrifice to idols? I mean, that just doesn't seem to mesh with everything else he's doing, because that would raise a whole bunch of red flags. And even the most lax young man who was raised to observe the Jewish faith, Torah, even the most lax in his faith in God, after all, where was God when we were being carted off to Babylon? Even the most lax and lazy faith in a young man would have raised a huge red flag once they started eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols or that wasn't kosher. I mean, what would have made more sense for Nebuchadnezzar, right? I mean, for him to win their favor by abiding by kosher law, or for him to fly in the face of that? Maybe just a real-time example. Which politician do you vote for more often than not? The one who gets up and lists everything wrong with Christianity, or the one who ends his speeches by saying, God bless you and God bless America? Right? Oh man, we got to vote for that guy. He just said, God bless America. Must be a Christian. You know, it's like, they know those things. Nebuchadnezzar knew those things. So is he really going to fly in the face of kosher law here? That seems very unlikely given everything else about this guy. So what is Daniel's deal? If it's not just everything in moderation, if it's not about stuff being kosher, if it's none of those things, what's going on? Well, I'll tell you this. Daniel knew the king's real intent was more than just food. Nebuchadnezzar's intent was more than just about food. As I said, Nebuchadnezzar knew that daily provision would be a greater shackle than chains. You know, as I was studying this passage, I came across something that an old theologian named John Calvin said. I wanted you to see what John Calvin said. It'll be on the screens for you. John Calvin said this on this passage. Daniel abstained at first from the luxuries of the court to escape being tampered with. It was lawful for him and his companions, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, to feed on any kind of diet, but he perceived the king's intention. We know how far enticements prevail to deceive us, especially when we are treated daintily. Do you know what John Calvin is saying there? He's saying when we're treated well, when we're indulging ourselves, when life is good, we are so easily deceived. Our alarm sensors shut down when life is comfortable. And what Calvin is saying about Daniel is that Daniel knew exactly what Nebuchadnezzar's scheme was. He knew exactly what he was trying to do. Nebuchadnezzar didn't care about the food. He cared about getting their hearts to be allegiant to him. He cared more about their allegiance to him. He wanted to reprogram them and strip away their allegiance to Yahweh, their God. He wanted to strip that away so that he could replace that with himself. And so Nebuchadnezzar, a very shrewd man. I mean, you don't get to be a world power, a world emperor, if you're a dummy. I mean, he knew what he was doing, and Daniel saw right through it. You might be thinking, okay, well, how much damage could that really have done? Just going along with the program. Well, as I started to say, Daniel was carried away at a very young age. I mean, he may have been 15 or 16, maybe 17 at this time. And you remember your 15 or 16 or 17-year-old selves, right? Okay? For some, that was longer ago than others, but we're not going there today. We're talking about Daniel, okay? But you remember yourselves and your ability to make decisions. So think of what it must have been for Daniel to be ripped from home, to have to say goodbye to mom and dad, and in all likelihood, watch them be killed. And to cry out to God, and it feels like he's silent. Many of you have been there. I've been there. And so you're carted away to a major world city, and you don't know what awaits you. It could be starvation. It could be enslavement. Maybe torture. Maybe disease. Maybe death. And so on the bus, so to speak, to Babylon, your heart is it's just a wreck. It's angry and depressed all at the same time. You don't know what's going to happen. But you get to Babylon, and you're cleaned up, you're given clean clothes, and you're immediately brought to a feast where you're served at the dinner table, and someone says to you, with compliments from the king himself. I mean, aren't you going to develop some positive feelings towards your captor? I mean, we call that Stockholm syndrome, where those in bondage develop a positive feeling, even an affection for those who are their captors. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar knew that, even though it didn't have that title. And even today, we say things like this: don't bite the hand that feeds you, right? Nebuchadnezzar knew all of that. So you might say, well, how much damage could it have been if he had just gone along with the program and eaten the king's choice food and wine? Well, the answer, an incredible amount. An incredible amount of damage, maybe even irreparable damage. Because Nebuchadnezzar knew that daily provision was a greater shackle than even chains. He saw through the scheme. Because Daniel knew that this test of the food and wine would actually be the easiest in Babylon, not the most difficult. This test on whether he would defile himself with the king's food and wine, that would be the simplest thing for him, not the hardest. And he knew that this was only the beginning. So he resolves. He purposes in his heart. He decides. He makes up his mind. He determines not to move off of this conviction that he would not defile himself. In fact, that leads to the big idea that if you hear nothing else from this morning, you need to hear this. This is what we learned from the life of Daniel. It's on the screen for you. Daniel resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of the world. If you hear nothing else, hear that. Daniel resolved. He purposed in his heart. He made up his mind. I think he made up his mind before he ever reached Babylon, on the bus, so to speak, to Babylon, that he would not defile himself. Why? Because Daniel resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of the world. Let me show you how that works out. Because in Daniel 1:8, they say, hey, we're not going to defile ourselves this way. Now look at verse 9 in our text, Daniel 1, verse 9. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. The English Standard Version is even more direct. And God gave Daniel favor. When Daniel resolves, chapter 1, verse 8, God shows favor, chapter 1, verse 9. Daniel decided, he made up his mind, 15, 16, 17 years old, that he would choose the favor of God over the pleasures of the world every time. And God blessed his life as a consequence. That mean everything was easy for Daniel? Absolutely not. But he decided that proximity to God was of greater value to him than any indulgence that the world could extend to him. So he decides, you know what? I'm not going to defile myself with the king's food and wine. And after 10 days of eating vegetables and water, I mean vegan diet, all right? Have you ever tried to be vegan? Some of you have, and I don't know how you do it. I envy your faith, because we tried that for a week. I was vegan for a week, all right? Not even 10 days, a week. And you know what got us, Gabe and me? Three words: Parmesan cheese substitute. For an Italian, those are the three most horrifying words in the English language. Parmesan cheese substitute. So that was the end for us. But Daniel, he for 10 days says vegetables and water. And after 10 days, they were found to look healthier and smarter and wiser than anybody else in the program. If we continued on in reading Daniel chapter 1, we'd see that at the end of the 3 years, everybody who's been in the program, the Babylon Indoctrination Institute, everybody that was at BII, they get brought before Nebuchadnezzar, right? And Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are all found to be of an upper crust than everybody else in the program. After 3 years, God showed favor because they resolved. But we could keep going, because in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and nobody can interpret the dream. All of Nebuchadnezzar's advisors and his enchanters and his magicians, nobody can interpret the dream. In fact, they can't even tell him what his dream was. And he's like, I'm not going to tell you what the dream is. If I tell you, then you're just going to make something up. I want you to tell me what the dream is, and then tell me what it means. And so in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar, he promises a whole bunch of rewards and honor and opulence and favor to anybody who can interpret his dream. And nobody can do it. But Daniel is brought in. Let me show you this in Daniel chapter 2, verse 26. It says this: the king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it? Verse 27, Daniel replied, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the vision that passed through your mind as you were lying in bed are these. And he goes on to explain the dream. But did you notice that with this offer of, hey, anybody who can tell me what that dream was and interpret it, I'll give them pretty much huge status in my kingdom. And so Daniel is asked, are you able to do that? What does he say? No one can do that. No man can do that. But there is a God who can. And he has shown you, Nebuchadnezzar, what this is all about. He takes himself completely out of the equation. Why? Because Daniel resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of this world. Would it have been awesome for him to take on all this recognition and favor and status? Sure, but guess what? God gave it to him anyway. God gave it to him anyway because Daniel resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of the world. But we don't have to stop there, because a couple chapters later, Nebuchadnezzar's son, Belshazzar, is now king, and he's throwing a party in his palace, and they're using the chalices, some of those holy artifacts that chapter 1 mentioned that were taken from Solomon's temple. So the holy instruments for the Jewish faith were being used to get lit. I mean, they weren't just drinking socially in this chapter, all right? Now, Belshazzar and his kingdom, they're just going nuts, and they're using the temple chalices to do it. And so all of a sudden, a hand appears and starts writing on the wall. And so you can imagine the hysteria that ensued. They're like, what does that even mean? And so they don't know what's going on. So they bring Daniel in, because he seems to have a knack for these things. And they say, Daniel, what does this mean? And look at Belshazzar's interaction with Daniel in chapter 5, verse 16. He says this: now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Here's this offer. Then Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Why would Daniel do that? Because he resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of this world? Could he have come in and said, yeah, I'll be saving the day today? And let me tell you what this interpretation is and what this handwriting means. And he could have done all of that. But what does he say? He says, you know what? You can have it. He tells the king, you can have it. Why? Because the judgment that God was about to bring on Belshazzar and his kingdom, it was a swift one. And Daniel, he says, I want to get out of the way of this. And so he steps back, interprets the vision, and that very night, Belshazzar is wiped out and his kingdom is erased. And Daniel is there in the midst. He could have taken on a place of status and opulence and been given all of this. Didn't matter to him. Nothing could shake Daniel because he had resolved, he had made up his mind that nothing would shake him off of that conviction. In Daniel chapter 6, there's a new king, Darius. And Darius gives a decree that no prayers can be said to anybody but him. And this is kind of there's a backstory to this that we can't go into. But Daniel knows about this decree. And if he had any wits about him, he would have just complied. But Daniel chapter 6, verse 10 says this. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Why? Because Daniel resolved that the favor of God tasted better than the pleasures of this world, and nothing could shake Daniel off of that conviction. And because of that, God blessed his life. Again, did that mean everything went smoothly for Daniel? No, he never saw his family again. He never returned to Jerusalem again, let alone Judea. He's stuck there in Babylon. But the resolution of this guy at 16 is just as strong 70-some years later when he's in his 80s. This guy was not shaken off of anything because he had learned to trust God and know that the favor of God was better than anything else that the world could extend to him. And nothing, no king, whether it was Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar or Darius or anybody, it didn't matter, because no matter who was on the throne in Babylon, Daniel knew who was on the throne in heaven. And that never changed for him. And because he knew that, he was able to resolve that the favor of God is far better than the pleasures of this world, because the heart of the king, Proverbs says, is in the hand of God, and he turns it like a river however he chooses to. If you remember our message on David got in trouble because he forgot who the real king was. Daniel was able to resolve because he never did. So what does that mean for you and me, us sitting here today? What does that do for us? Well, a couple things. One is this, that Daniel understood a principle that we need to grasp, and that is the principle of compromise. I realize that even that wording is a little ironic, because often when we compromise, we're compromising our principles. But there's actually a principle of compromise that says this: your present compromise makes for a very weak future. Your present compromise makes for a weak future. Let me show you how this works. Because for us, when temptation is in front of us, it feels like an immense pressure is building. Building. And so we think that the only way to get out from under that pressure is to give in to temptation. We even say things like, I couldn't take the pressure. And so we think that when this pressure builds from temptation, the only way to get out from under that is just to slide out, give in to temptation, and say, well, we'll get them next time, kid. Well, now I'm better equipped to fight off temptation next time because man, that's foolish. Because giving in to temptation, compromise, does not strengthen us for the future. It weakens us for the future. If we're just honest, the second drink went down a lot smoother than the first. The second time you cheated, it didn't sting your conscience quite like the first. And once you lied at work to cast yourself in a better light and you actually got a promotion or a bump in salary or a pat on the back or a parking space, it made it that much easier the next time, didn't it? Why? Because what Daniel knew, we need to know, and that is your present compromise, your compromise right now, weakens you for the future. Does not strengthen you. I mean, what if Daniel had compromised? What if, right? Do we even have a book of Daniel? If any record of his life existed, which is doubtful, would it have said, you know, Daniel 1:1, and that was it. And it said, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were carried down to Babylon, and there they died. If Daniel doesn't resolve, that's the end of the story. But that's not how the story ended. Because Daniel decided, he made up his mind, he purposed in his heart that the favor of God was far better than the pleasures of this world. And you know, as you and I are here today, where we are in this country, you might be thinking, man, my life looks nothing like Daniel in Babylon. I mean, I couldn't be further from that. So our crossroads may look slightly different. But the principles are the same. You see, the Apostle Paul was actually given insight into what society would look like as history inched closer and closer to consummation, the end. And it's a pretty spot-on description of the times that we find ourselves in right now at our crossroads. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. It'll be on the screen. But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure, rather than lovers of God. And so where we find ourselves standing at the crossroads is this. Will we choose to follow the path that few will find? Will we choose the path that is narrow and jagged and difficult to navigate and few people to find it? Or will we choose the path that is wide and smooth, and many who find it? Which one will we choose as we stand at the crossroads? Listen. Because your decision now at the crossroads, one thing can change everything. One thing here can change everything. Let's land this plane for you. Let's apply this right here. Okay, listen. Students, listen to me right now. Look this way. Whichever campus you're at, Lockport campus or Cross Point campus, look this way. As you're getting ready to head off to college or head off to school in maybe a professional school or head off to the military or head off to a new job or any number of things, this might be the last message that you hear before doing that. This might be the last sermon that you hear before heading off. And you know, as I was beginning the message this morning and talked about the four teenage guys studying abroad in a major world city, that both petrified your parents and excited you. Because all you can think about now is how you can't wait to get away from home, away from rules, away from mom and dad, away from mom and dad's religion, and in your mind, away from God. You can't wait for that. And so you've just been itching the whole time to get out from underneath of mom and dad's authority so you can run and do your own thing. But let me tell you, student, you are heading for a path of self destruction. You're at the crossroads. And I can tell you that out of everybody in this room right now, I'm probably the closest in age to you. Where it wasn't that long ago that I stood right where you did. Maybe it was forever ago in your mind for mom and dad or grandma and grandpa or uncle, aunt and uncle. Maybe it was forever ago for them. But it wasn't that long ago for me. And so I remember very clearly what it was like to stand there and sit there in my dorm room in my college and decide, is this going to be for me? Is this going to be my faith? Or is it going to be mom and dad's faith? And I'll just do everything I can to make them feel comfortable back home. But I'm going to do my deal here. And I'll just tell them, you know, I'm doing some God stuff every once in a while. But I'm going to do my thing right here. It wasn't that long ago that I sat where you are sitting and where I stood where you now stand. And I got to tell you, with all of the hope and grace that I can, that if you do not turn back, you're going to face a path of self-destruction. And I care very little about how you feel about me yelling at you right now, and care very much that you do not miss the fact that God has orchestrated the events of your life today for you to hear this message, not because of the mouthpiece, but because of his word. That like Daniel, who resolved at your age not to defile himself, he resolved that the pleasure of God, the favor of God, was far better than the pleasures of the world, that you, right now, can resolve that. You can make up your mind today that college is not going to be 4 years of partying and then you'll sort your life out with Jesus after. That you'll kind of do your own thing at college, come home and give God a what's up on Sunday. That you will resolve that the favor of God tastes better than the pleasures of this world. I hope you don't miss that. I hope you don't miss that. Because one thing can change everything. But this isn't just a going away to college message. This is for us, sir, ma'am. Because for years, maybe you've worked really hard. You've given your life to your job. Long nights at the office or at the factory. Maybe you've given your life to your kids and given up vacations and stuff for yourself so that your kids could have dinner on the table and all that stuff, go to have clean clothes for school and all that. And so now you find yourself in a place where you're ready for a little me time. You're ready to give yourself to a bit of indulgence because you deserve it after all. And that's why you entertain the advances of the younger and more attractive coworker or your trainer at the gym rather than being repulsed by those things. It's why when you have a bad day at work, you run to a bottle when you have a bad day, which maybe started as a Friday unwinding thing and has actually turned into an everyday unraveling in your life. I got to tell you, turn back. Turn back. It's why you use the statement retail therapy and actually believe in its power. It's why you will gamble and bet on a horse or a team or an athlete or anything to give you the thrill of an excitement. And in all of those cases, you don't have a lust problem. You don't have a drinking or a drug problem. You don't have a shopping problem or a gambling problem. You have a soul problem. You have an affections problem, not an infections problem, an affections problem, because your affection has been given to the pleasures of this world rather than the favor of God. And I got to tell you, turn back. I got to tell you, turn back. You know, the King James Version translates 2 Timothy 3:4 as lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, which is an inferior translation. As if you could love God and love the pleasures of this world. As if you could flirt with the pleasures of this world and everything that it offers to you and just give your heart wholly to all of those things and then check in with God on Sunday, clean things up, and go back to living like hell for the rest of the week. As if love for God could coexist with love for the pleasures of this world. It can't be done. It is lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Because what if I said to you, yeah, I love my wife, but I've also got this one on the side. I love both of them. I love my wife more. You'd think this guy's an idiot. That's why it doesn't work like that. You cannot love the pleasures of this world and love God at the same time. And what Daniel resolved was that the favor of God, his path, was better every time. It tasted better than the pleasures of this world. And you need to wake up and hear that message from God today. It's not too late. It's not too late. No one is too far from him. I got to tell you this. With this thought, we're done. That Daniel found himself in a place where he was able to resolve because he remembered where he was from. He remembered his home country. He remembered to whom he belonged. He remembered his citizenship. In fact, Paul gives us some encouragement in Philippians chapter 3, verse 18, that we need to hear. For as I have often told you before, and now tell you again, even with tears, many live as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their destiny is destruction. Their God is their stomach or their desires, and their glory is in their shame. Their mind is set on earthly things, but our citizenship is in heaven. And we eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ. Don't forget, Christ follower, don't forget your citizenship. Don't forget where you're from. Don't forget your home country or to whom you belong. Because have you not tasted and seen that the Lord is good? Have you not experienced his favor in your life, that he took you from where you were caught in sin and brought you into everlasting life with Jesus Christ? Have you not tasted his favor and his goodness? Or has it been so long after flirting with worldly pleasure that you don't even know what that looks like anymore? To choose God's path over your own. Or maybe there may be some in this room here at the Lockport campus or at the Cross Point campus or watching online that you've never even begun that journey of faith. And to all of us, I'd say this: you're at a crossroads. What will you choose? Let's bow together in a word of prayer. I'd ask that wherever you are under the sound of my voice, if you would, out of respect for those around you, maybe you'd bow your head, and if it helps you to close your eyes so that you would not be a distraction or be distracted by those around you. And I want to leave room for God to speak to you specifically about how to press this truth into your life right now. So say, God, what are you trying to show me from the life of Daniel? If you're here or you're at the Cross Point campus, we're going to give you opportunity in just a moment to follow up. For some of you, maybe it means saying no to something that you've been saying yes to for a very long time. And today would be your resolve day. I will resolve not to defile myself with this. For some of you, you need to begin a journey of following Jesus Christ. At the Lockport campus, come see me right down front after we're done in a moment. At the Cross Point campus, Pastor Jerry will give you instruction in just a moment on how to follow up there. Father, thanks for your word. We need you. We need to hear from you because we sometimes find ourselves sick and tired of being sick and tired and just so done with the mess we've made of things that we need you to step in, knowing that no one is too far for you to reach. No one is beyond your grace in Jesus Christ. That's the message of hope that you want each person here to understand and know. So God, help us to be people who in the midst of a culture heading in one direction at the crossroads, we would have the courage and the resolve of Daniel to choose a different path, knowing that this is the path that Jesus himself is leading us on. We trust you to do that in his name and through his spirit. Amen.